This is the structure of the Urantia book. This is what the book is all about. Philosophically, this book means a great deal to me because it helps me to avoid the two major errors in human thinking which seem to characterize most societies, most civilizations. This book helps me not be a spiritist. A spiritist, I would say, well, a good Buddhist would be like this. He just says the physical world isn't real, let's not bother about it. A good Hindu, a thinking Hindu, knows this is true too. A medieval Christian simply said, when trouble hit him, the Lord giveth, the Lord taketh away, blessed be the name of the Lord. Now, the revolt against that is a humanistic secular revolt. Starting with the Renaissance in Italy, men dug up the concepts of early Greek civilization and began thinking. And they said, now wait a minute. Sure, the Lord giveth, but I'm not so sure it's the Lord that's taking away. Let's do something about plagues and lack of sanitary conditions and human comforts. And the result has been the flowering of a wonderful materialistic civilization. But as men began to attack superstition, they wound up by attacking religion as such. And today, we ignore God. We've fallen in love with science. And today we're in trouble, because if we leave God out of the picture, we can't stop worshiping. Men are incurably worshipful. And when they stop worshiping God, they tend to worship power. And as they begin to worship power, they end by worshiping the state. And if they start out conservative, they end fascist. And if they start out liberal, they end communist. And I can't see much difference between one and the other. And so our tremendous secular civilization that's done so much for us materially has now got us to the place where for the first time the whole human race is scared. In my generation, we have scientifically killed more people than have been killed by war in the last 2,000 years. This is not the way to do it. This book tells me that the only way you can quit matter is with mind. When man attacks his material environment thinking and scientifically, he wins. He doesn't win by praying. But if you don't ally mind with spirit, then the power that you develop in whipping your environment begets fear, not trust. And I submit that's exactly the condition the world is in today. This book admonishes me that because I am a person, I can make decisions, I have relative free will, and I can take this matter-whipping, matter-dominating mind and subordinate it to spirit. And then, any power which such a spirit-led mortal has, such power begets no fear. This book teaches me that when I deal with matter, I should be hard-headed and use reason, mathematics, and science. But when I'm dealing with values, I should use faith. I should generate a religion. This book teaches me that neither science nor religion, in their pure states, touch at any point, but that both are intriguingly touched by philosophy. For it is my privilege to attempt to use logic in the pursuit of truth and the elaboration of meanings. These papers teach me that God is love, and that love is the desire to do good to others. That's the Urantia book to me, in non-technical terms. The only technical term I used was Urantia. Do you want to discuss it at all? Yes.
When you say that God is, or a peace of God is within us, do you feel that, well, it's hard to say that your center, I have thought, perhaps this is incorrect, but I have thought that all of us are complete worlds within ourselves,
mm-hmm.
but connected to the one.
To the God, Father?
Presence,
yes.
I see up here.
Yes.
And that when you find your center, all things are possible.
Yes, agreed.
And it's a point of balance, and that is God.
That center,
which is a complete.
Yes. The papers teach, I call these the papers because they refer to themselves as papers rather than chapters.
Mm-hmm.
I could say the chapters teach, but they list themselves as paper one, paper two, paper three. Why they didn't call them chapters, I don't know. The book teaches that each person is linked to God by a circuit. And that in the case of human beings, there's a double linkage, not only a circuit, which causes us to have relative free will, and as far as God's concerned, absolute free will, but also this peace is pulling us in. And that our job is to find God on the outside, at the center of all things, at Amiga, through collaboration with this peace of God on the inside. These papers teach that the human soul is conceived when this peace of God invades the human mind. And the soul is a new entity, and it's actually conceived, and we are carrying our souls around, so to speak, in embryo. And at death, the soul is born.
Would that be what is called the silver cord?
I don't know that term.
Have you heard that? Well,
I don't know the term, so I can't answer that.
It's almost an electrical. Could it be likened to an electrical?
Well, only on the human end. The mind of man is certainly electrical, and the mind of man is the mother of the evolving soul. This invading peace of God is the Father, and the invasion of the mind results in a conception. Mm-hmm. Yes, Mr. Kuhn.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I'm confused here with this concept, that with the death, our soul is born?
Yes.
Now, what happened before that?
The soul in embryo.
Exactly.
We're carrying the soul.
Now,
it's a period of gestation of the soul, just like a baby.
It
lives 9 months before it's born. And so the soul lives within the womb of the human mind for many years before it's born.
I'm confused because
certainly.
I feel funny with the soulless life, I mean embryonic soul in myself. I thought we have the potential, the immanent God, the potential within us, and it depends on our inner awareness, whether how much this God quality within us we become aware of it, or
yes.
Awaken.
Yes.
So that even with living we have a tiny little bit of it.
Yes, exactly. Yes, quite.
Definitely.
Or should I say Yagi this?
I was thinking also of God with Christ within. How is this idea that we are talking so often in our, at least I'm thinking often and hear about it, the idea of Christ within, the center within us, that we have the Christ quality also within us.
The peace of God is within us.
Yeah.
The spirit of Christ, or the spirit of truth, as the book refers to it, is immediately around us, and there is a possibility of collaboration between these two spiritual influences, as there is among all spiritual influences which may touch us. Yes, the book teaches the presence of both spirits, but the spirit of truth is an influence that impinges on us, whereas this peace, this fragment of God, is actually within us. This fragment of God is intended to be the spirit nucleus of an absolutely stable nature around which we can grow. And the book teaches me that as long as that spirit nucleus is the massive and stable center of my personality system, I'm going on. And the only way I can really mess it up is if I try to put myself in the place of that spirit nucleus. Myself functions as an orbital electron. It's not of nuclear mass. Yes, that's right. Such a nuisance.
Different ways of saying.
Yes. The ego is such a nuisance, but if we didn't have them, we'd be awfully dead, wouldn't we?
What do you do with the phrase, unless ye are born again, we cannot?
That birth is a... Let me paraphrase that. You have been born once as an animal. And you may live as an animal and die as an animal. Philosophically speaking, never once rising above the mere animal urge to live. Unless you can be further born as a true human being, you're not a son of God. And this means, philosophically, you pass from the animal urge to live to an espousal of the quest to master the human art of living. Behavior becomes conduct because there is purpose behind it, intelligent purpose. These are the philosophical repercussions as I see them. Spiritually, you develop new qualities of love. You don't cease to be selfish. But to selfishness, you now add altruism, the will to service. You desire to do good to others. This to me, the rebirth that Jesus talked about is a complete spiritual thing, but I understand it better if I put it in the words I've just used. Stop being a mammal and start being a real, true human being.
You mean with killing the or outgrowing the animal nature, not being directed anymore by our instinctual drives and all what Freud tells us? Sex drive and instinctual drive. And
this you can't escape as long as you have the chemistry of endocrinology within you. As long as you have ductless glands, you're going to have these drives, but they can be sublimated. They do not have to be expressed animalistically.
Yeah, so we master.
Yes. We live with them. We harmonize them. We never stop being mammalian, but we stop living like mammals.
Well, how many stages can we go through in this life as a now? I mean, we do progress. And can't you...
The papers tell us that we go through 7 levels. But we may die on any one of these. That's why beta has to have grades in it. Beta has got to be able to accommodate Dr. Schweitzer and Mr. Hottentot. And Mr. Hottentot's a good citizen, you know? So beta has got to be very primitive and simple in its lower levels and quite complicated. And beta has got to accommodate people who come from planets perhaps far in advance of us in civilization. Where were we?
I just wondered, in this life now.
They tell us that there are 7 levels that we go through. Now, we're not particularly conscious of these. They tell us we have 7 grades which we should traverse, but unfortunately, death usually catches us before we graduate. So what is undone here must be completed on beta. When you study what they say about beta or the mansion worlds, then you realize that everybody gets a pretty square deal. Because what we miss here, we will get up there. Or we will get the nearest equivalent that we can get. Some things are unique in this life. We can't exactly get them on the mansion worlds, but we can get at least a good ersatz.
Well,
a good substitute. Yes?
Would you say something about prayer? If it's any good, who do you pray to?
Well, prayer.
Anything on that?
How about helping the people that just do his prayer? How about helping some of these people? Is that part of what he's talking about? Can we do that?
The papers say this about prayer. First of all, prayer is not worship. Because prayer usually asks for something, and worship asks for nothing. They tell us that most of our worship we're not really conscious of. It takes place on the superconscious level of mind. The papers posit a superconscious as well as a subconscious. Concerning prayer, they say, let me read you what they say about prayer. It's quite beautiful. And I'll read you anything non-technical here, where we don't have a lot of strange terms. Let me read you what they say about prayer, praying as a personal experience. 1001. There is a truly spontaneous aspect to prayer, for primitive man found himself praying long before he had any clear concept of a God. Early man was wont to pray in two diverse situations. When in dire need, he experienced the impulse to reach out for help, and when jubilant, he indulged the impulsive expression of joy. Prayer is not an evolution of magic. They each arose independently. Magic was an attempt to adjust deity to conditions. Prayer is an effort to adjust the personality to the will of deity. True prayer is both moral and religious. Magic is neither. Prayer may become an established custom. Many pray because others do. Still others pray because they fear something direful may happen if they do not offer their regular supplications. To some individuals, prayer is the calm expression of gratitude. To others, a group expression of praise, social devotions. Sometimes it is the imitation of another's religion, while in true prayer, it is the sincere and trusting communication of the spiritual nature of the creature with the anywhere presence of the spirit of the Creator. Prayer may be a spontaneous expression of God consciousness or a meaningless recitation of theologic formulas. It may be the ecstatic praise of a God-knowing soul or the slavish obeisance of a fear-ridden mortal. It is sometimes the pathetic expression of spiritual craving, and sometimes the blatant shouting of pious phrases. Prayer may be joyous praise or a humble plea for forgiveness. Prayer may be the childlike plea for the impossible, or the mature entreaty for moral growth and spiritual power. A petition may be for daily bread, or may embody a wholehearted yearning to find God and to do His will. It may be a wholly selfish request, or a true and magnificent gesture toward the realization of unselfish brotherhood. Prayer may be an angry cry for vengeance, or a merciful intercession for one's enemies. It may be the expression of a hope of changing God, or the powerful technique of changing oneself. It may be the cringing plea of a lost sinner before a supposedly stern judge, or the joyful expression of a liberated son of the living and merciful Heavenly Father. Modern man is perplexed by the thought of talking things over with God in a purely personal way. Many have abandoned regular praying. They only pray when under unusual pressure, in emergencies. Man should be unafraid to talk to God. but only a spiritual child would undertake to persuade or presume to change God. But real praying does attain reality. Even when the air currents are ascending, no bird can soar except by outstretched wings. Prayer elevates man because it is a technique of progressing by the utilization of the ascending spiritual currents of the universe. Genuine prayer adds to spiritual growth, modifies attitudes, and yields that satisfaction which comes from communion with divinity. It is a spontaneous outburst of God consciousness. God answers man's prayer by giving him an increased revelation of truth, an enhanced appreciation of beauty, and an augmented concept of goodness. Prayer is a subjective gesture, but it contacts with mighty objective realities on the spiritual levels of human experience. It is a meaningful reach by the human for superhuman values. It is the most potent spiritual growth stimulus. Words are irrelevant to prayer. They are merely the intellectual channel in which the river of spiritual supplication may chance to flow. The word value of a prayer is purely auto-suggestive in private devotions and socio-suggestive in group devotions. God answers the soul's attitude, not the words. Prayer is not a technique of escape from conflict, but rather a stimulus to growth in the very face of conflict. Pray only for values, not things, for growth, not for gratification. If you would engage in effective praying, you should bear in mind the laws of prevailing petitions. 1. You must qualify as a potent prayer by sincerely and courageously facing the problems of universe reality. You must possess cosmic stamina. 2. You must have honestly exhausted the human capacity for human adjustment. You must have been industrious. 3. You must surrender every wish of mind and every craving of soul to the transforming embrace of spiritual growth. You must have experienced an enhancement of meanings and an elevation of values. 4. You must make a wholehearted choice of the divine will. You must obliterate the dead center of indecision. 5. You not only recognize the Father's will and choose to do it, but you have effected an unqualified consecration and a dynamic dedication to the actual doing of the Father's will. 6. Your prayer will be directed exclusively for divine wisdom to solve the specific human problems encountered in the paradise ascension, the attainment of divine perfection. 7. And you must have faith, living faith. Isn't that beautiful? That's what they say about prayer. They also point out that much prayer is psychological as well as spiritual. If you have a purely material problem and can, in all sincerity, pray about it, you probably will work out the answer right within your own mind, because prayer is real on the mental level as well as the spiritual level. And if you really pray about something, you probably, if you can work out the answer, this is one of the ways, with your purely human resources, you'll figure out what to do.
Then it's prayer and meditation, then nearly the same.
Yes, except worship. Meditation, yes.
Because at one point you read that it is not the words that God reacts to, but
right.
The soul's inner attitude. Well, that's meditation.
Yes, of course. And then there's another form of praying. talking things over with God in a purely personal way. Just sitting down and talking. You know, it always has seemed to me a little bit unfair never to bother God unless you want something. I'm sure he doesn't mind. There's one time when my children were in college, I was sure to hear from them if they ran short of the money. But it was nice occasionally to hear from them when they really didn't need anything.
In other words, Billy would say, once in a while we should say, well, dear God, how are you up there?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. I find it easier to do, based on what this book teaches me. I can't quite be casual with an infinite being at the center of all things, even though I have no fear of him whatsoever. You know, if he were a little smaller, I could be afraid of him. But he's so big, it's silly to be afraid of anyone that big. But I feel diffident about passing the time of day with him. But this piece of him inside of me, I don't have any such feeling of diffidence. This is the love of God individuated and given to me. This is my partner. I can sit down and chat with him very comfortably. He's not a person, but I know that if God's interested in what we're talking about, he can listen in. It's as handy as a telephone. This concept of the fragment of God, the piece of God within, makes God a very handy reality. It divests him of his infinity, but not of his quality of divinity. And I can talk to my partner. I can pass the time of day with him. I can ask him what he thinks of Bud's house. And I can try to explain to him what this house means to a human being, because since this piece of God is a pure spirit entity, I'm quite certain that material realities are very unreal to him. When we go to a strange town together, I try to tell him a little about the history of the town and what it's like. He's trying to tell me about God. I try to tell him about this earth, where I'm at home and where he is a stranger, a foreigner. I try to tell him what a sunset looks like, because this piece of God has no eyes. And he can know color only as I see color. I try to tell him about the fragrance of the woods in the springtime, and of all the beauty of this world, which just can't register on him, because he just doesn't have my sensory mechanism. We do a lot of talking, and I never get any answers. But that's not his fault. I can talk, but you see, I happen to be deaf.
I'm just
feeling
much better after you have
talked. Feelings, yes, but not words. And if I ever heard words, they would frighten me half out of my wits. I would immediately consult a competent psychiatrist and tell him I was on the verge of paranoia. One thing which has intrigued me, I've been very interested in the people who are interested in this book. And as a group, they've had good humor. They have not taken themselves seriously. Or if they've had a touch of this, it hasn't lasted very long. I once told a group that I had to do with for a long time, I said, if this group ever loses its ability to laugh at funny things, and that includes ourselves because human beings are indescribably funny, if this group ever starts taking themselves seriously, I said, I'm going to pay you the supreme insult. I'm going to pray for you in public and to your faces. This is no more insulting thing could be done to people. Now, the folks that have seemed to take an interest in this have been average people. I'm a management consultant by trade. I make my living solving business problems. And I'm probably one of the most improbable persons to be associated with a religious movement that you could ever meet. There's nothing hierarchical about me, you know. I can teach pretty well, but preaching is not in me. You want me to read you some more from the book?
Let me read you some passages. The English is very lovely.
There is in the mind of God a plan which embraces every creature of all his vast domains. And this plan is an eternal purpose of boundless opportunity, unlimited progress, and endless life. And the infinite treasures of such a matchless career are yours for the choosing. The goal of eternity is ahead. The adventure of divinity attainment lies before you. The race for perfection is on. Whosoever will may enter, and certain victory will crown the efforts of every human being who will run the race of faith and trust, depending every step of the way on the leading of the indwelling Spirit of God and on the guidance of that good Spirit of His Son, which so freely has been poured out upon all flesh. This book is written like music. It's not written like a textbook, which adds somewhat to our problems in studying it, because when we study it intellectually, we want to make a textbook out of it. But this book actually is written the way a symphony is written. This book introduces major themes, minor themes. They reappear in different keys, in different tempos, with different expressions. So, could I read you the overture which contains the principal movement of this very lovely symphony? This is the movement that runs all the way through and keeps repairing. This is the introduction to paper one. That's right where an overture would be, you'd expect to find it. The Universal Father is the God of all creation, the first source and center of all things and beings. First think of God as a creator, then as a controller, and lastly as an infinite upholder. The truth about the Universal Father had begun to dawn upon mankind when the prophet said, "You, God, are alone. There is none beside you. You have created the heaven and the heaven of heavens with all their hosts. You preserve and control them. By the sons of God were the universes made. The Creator covers himself with light as with a garment and stretches out the heavens as a curtain." Only the concept of the Universal Father, one God in the place of many gods, enabled mortal man to comprehend the Father as divine creator and infinite controller. The myriads of planetary systems were all made to be eventually inhabited by many different types of intelligent creatures, beings who could know God, receive the divine affection, and love Him in return. The universe of universes is the work of God and the dwelling place of His diverse creatures. God created the heavens and formed the earth. He established the universe and created this world not in vain. He formed it to be inhabited. The enlightened worlds all recognize and worship the Universal Father, the eternal maker and infinite upholder of all creation. The will creatures of universe upon universe have embarked upon the long paradise journey, the fascinating struggle of the eternal adventure of attaining God the Father. The transcendent goal of the children of time is to find the eternal God, to comprehend the divine nature, to recognize the Universal Father. God-knowing creatures have only one supreme ambition, just one consuming desire, and that is to become as they are in their spheres, like him, as he is in his paradise perfection of personality, and in his universal sphere of righteous supremacy. From the universal Father, who inhabits eternity, there has gone forth the supreme mandate, be you perfect, even as I am perfect. In love and mercy, the messengers of paradise have carried this divine exhortation down through the ages and out through the universes, even to such lowly animal origin creatures as the human races of Urantia. This magnificent and universal injunction to strive for the attainment of the perfection of divinity is the first duty and should be the highest ambition of all the struggling creature creation of the God of perfection. This possibility of the attainment of divine perfection is the final and certain destiny of all man's eternal spiritual progress. Urantia mortals can hardly hope to be perfect in the infinite sense, but it is entirely possible for human beings, starting out as they do on this planet, to attain the supernal and divine goal which the infinite God has set for mortal men. And when they do achieve this destiny, they will, in all that pertains to self-realization and mind attainment, be just as replete in their sphere of divine perfection as God himself is in his sphere of infinity and eternity. Such perfection may not be universal in the material sense, unlimited in intellectual grasp, or final in spiritual experience. But it is final and complete in all finite aspects of divinity of will, perfection of personality motivation, and God consciousness. This is the true meaning of that divine command, be you perfect, even as I am perfect, which ever urges mortal man onward and beckons him inward in that long and fascinating struggle for the attainment of higher and higher levels of spiritual values and true universe meanings. This sublime search for the God of universes is the supreme adventure of the inhabitants of all the worlds of time and space. This is the major thing. Yes.
Page 21.
Slightly paraphrasing. Let me read you from the last page in the book, where the theme is closed. Be not discouraged. Human evolution is still in progress. And the revelation of God to the world in and through Jesus shall not fail. The great challenge to modern man is to achieve better communication with the Spirit of God that dwells within the human mind. Man's greatest adventure in the flesh consists in the well-balanced and sane effort to advance the borders of self-consciousness out through the dim realms of embryonic soul consciousness in a wholehearted effort to reach the borderland of spirit consciousness, contact with the divine presence. Such an experience constitutes God consciousness, an experience mightily confirmative of the pre-existent truth of the religious experience of knowing God. Such spirit consciousness is the equivalent of the knowledge of the actuality of sonship with God. Otherwise, the assurance of sonship is the experience of faith. And God consciousness is equivalent to the integration of the self with the universe and on its highest levels of spiritual reality. Only the spirit content of any value is imperishable. Even that which is true and beautiful and good may not perish in human experience. If man does not choose to survive, then does the indwelling spirit of God conserve those realities born of love and nurtured in service. And all these things are a part of the Universal Father. The Father is living love, and this life of the Father is in his sons, and the Spirit of the Father is in his sons' sons, mortal man. When all is said and done, the Father idea is still the highest human concept of God. That's the opening and closing theme of the most fascinating symphony I've ever read. It is a symphony. It's symphonic in its construction.
Did you say that it was written in 1935 or
6? That's the dating of the papers, yes. Mid-30s. I think, is it 34?
34
and 35.
35.
I haven't checked those dates in a long time.
Instead of that time, it would be better understood because of radio.
Yes, I've often thought, why did they do this now? It's a good question. Well, I don't think they could have written this much before the development of wireless. We had to get our science going. Example, they mention that scene in the book of Daniel when he saw the Ancient of Days seated on the throne, and his hair and beard were like carded wool, and out of the throne came thunder and lightnings. They tell us that's the universe communication broadcasts. Now, until we have the word broadcast, until we know about electricity, we're going to be stuck where Daniel was when they showed him a broadcast. He did the best he could. He interpreted it in terms of all the electricity he knew, which was lightning. I think old Daniel was pretty bright to make that interpretation. And then, of course, as I look the world over, I can see why a book like this might appear. We are, I guess to use a service expression, it's gotten beyond snafu, it's fubar. Snafu, you know, is fouled up beyond all recognition. No, snafu is situation normal, all fouled up, and fubar is fouled up beyond all recognition or recovery. Yes.
Yeah, now my questions are all very beginner's questions.
Well, of course.
I'm interested in, especially with the conflict of the church and how the church represents Jesus. Now, what does this book give as the main reason that Jesus was sent? Now, the sonship that
you
read the last time.
What were his reasons for coming here?
Yeah, the purpose for his coming.
This book teaches very few negative points. But this book simply states that to believe that God was mad at us is blasphemous.
Yeah.
Anger in a father is hardly a credit to a human father, much less a divine father. Jesus had his own reasons for coming here, and I can give them to you briefly. He was earning sovereignty. A sovereignty over a part of this wide-spreading universe. As the papers instruct me, his domain will eventually embrace 10 million inhabited worlds, of which this is one. He's been working at this for the last 400 billion years, and he's much older than this. He's a paradise creator son of God. He's not a creature. He's a creator. He came here because until he had demonstrated his right to rule, he could rule only in the name of his Father, by divine right, not by experiential right. This was the seventh episode in his experiencing the life of the creature. And the first time he was born and died. The other six preceding episodes in the earning of sovereignty did not have to do with human beings. He came here and he was born because it was his objective to find out exactly what it was like to be a human being. And birth is a normal part, an inescapable part of the human experience. He accepted death because death also is a normal part of the human experience. The manner of his dying was contrived by men. It was not the will of God. It was the will of God that he meet death, but not a peculiarly cruel death. Before he began his public ministry, he had earned his sovereignty, so that he had nothing more to gain by staying here the last 4 years. This was a free will gift which he made to the human race. And his purpose during his public ministry, which is all we know about, except the few episodes at the time of his birth and when he was in Jerusalem at 12, his purpose those 4 years was to paint the perfect anthropomorphic picture of an infinite Father. He lived as God himself would have lived, were God flesh and blood. He wasn't trying to live as himself, but as a son of God, with the divinity potential to reveal God, he simply lived the life which God would live, were God a flesh and blood mortal, thus making God real and understandable to man. As the papers teach, Jesus' life is greater than Jesus' teachings. You can live the truth more effectively than you can speak it. That's what they teach about the purpose Jesus had in coming.
Well, that is the idea of the church, that he is our Savior and died for us.
Yes, I know. I know.
A little bit twisted.
The gospel that Jesus taught is God is your Father. God is the Father of each man. Hence, all men are brothers and should treat each other accordingly. The gospel of the church is have fellowship with the risen Lord through membership in the church, and accept deliverance from death because he died for us. This story got warped unintentionally by Peter on the day of Pentecost. Peter didn't mean to do this. You know, they're so kind to the people that made mistakes. They weren't deliberate mistakes. Jesus had warned the 12 to preach what he was preaching about God. But on the day of Pentecost, the 12 were so overjoyed about the risen Christ that they preached about Jesus instead of about God. And this was the great diversion of the Jesusonian gospel into the Christian gospel. Yes? Keep on asking questions. You're asking all the questions that some of these other folks maybe you're too timid to ask.
I didn't understand this question.
Yes.
The Jesusonian gospel, with other words, Peter twisted.
Yes.
The God message.
Yes.
Christ, really, Jesus Christ brought.
Yes.
And made it a Jesus gospel.
Yes, exactly. Jesus was no egotist.
That's so terrible.
as the papers, isn't that terrible? But Peter was bubbling over with the good news, and Peter was an impetuous extrovert. And gosh, it worked. It was exciting news. As the Blue Book says, it's the second best gospel the world has ever heard. The best gospel is the one the carpenter himself taught.
And it is so amazing what the church did. Jesus said, I have to leave, because he knew this. But I send you my counselor.
Yes.
And what did the church do? The church twisted that all around.
That's right. The trouble really starts with Paul. And well, what we have is a mix. May I read you about Christianity? Would you like to hear it?
Yeah.
This is quite some rhetoric now. So hang on to your intellectual seats. I'll read you the conclusion of next to the last paper. Christianity has indeed done a great service for this world, but what is now most needed is Jesus. The world needs to see Jesus living again on earth in the experience of spirit-born mortals who effectively reveal the Master to all men. It is futile to talk about a revival of primitive Christianity. You must go forward from where you find yourself. Modern culture must become spiritually baptized with a new revelation of Jesus' life and illuminated with a new understanding of his gospel of eternal salvation. And when Jesus becomes thus lifted up, he will draw all men to himself. Jesus' disciples should be more than conquerors, even overflowing sources of inspiration and enhanced living to all men. Religion is only an exalted humanism until it is made divine by the discovery of the reality of the presence of God in personal experience. The beauty and sublimity, the humanity and divinity, the simplicity and uniqueness of Jesus' life on earth presents such a striking and appealing picture of man saving and God revealing that the theologians and philosophers of all time should be effectively restrained from daring to form creeds or create theological systems of spiritual bondage out of such a transcendental bestowal of God in the form of man. In Jesus, the universe produced a mortal man in whom the spirit of love triumphed over the material handicaps of time and overcame the fact of physical origin. Ever bear in mind, God and men need each other. They are mutually necessary to the full and final attainment of eternal personality experience in the divine destiny of universe finality. The kingdom of God is within you was probably the greatest pronouncement Jesus ever made, next to the declaration that his Father is a living and loving Spirit. In winning souls for the Master, it is not the first mile of compulsion, duty, or convention that will transform man and his world, but rather the second mile of free service and liberty-loving devotion that betokens the Jesusonian reaching forth to grasp his brother in love and sweep him on under spiritual guidance towards the higher and divine goal of mortal existence. Christianity even now willingly goes the first mile, but mankind languishes and stumbles along in moral darkness because there are so few genuine second milers, so few professed followers of Jesus who really live and love as he taught his disciples to live and love and serve. The call to the adventure of building a new and transformed human society by means of the spiritual rebirth of Jesus' brotherhood of the kingdom should thrill all who believe in him as men have not been stirred since the days when they walked about on earth as his companions in the flesh. No social system or political regime which denies the reality of God can contribute in any constructive and lasting manner to the advancement of human civilization. But Christianity, as it is subdivided and secularized today, presents the greatest single obstacle to its further advancement. Especially is this true concerning the Orient.
What?
The Orient. Ecclesiasticism is at once and forever incompatible with that living faith, growing spirit, and first-hand experience of the faith comrades of Jesus in the brotherhood of man, in the spiritual association of the kingdom of heaven. The praiseworthy desire to preserve traditions of past achievement often leads to the defense of outgrown systems of worship. The well-meant desire to foster ancient thought systems effectually prevents the sponsoring of new and adequate means and methods designed to satisfy the spiritual longings of the expanding and advancing minds of modern men.
What page is it?
2084. Christianity is seriously confronted with the doom embodied in one of its own slogans: a house divided against itself cannot stand. The non-Christian world will hardly capitulate to a sect-divided Christendom. The living Jesus is the only hope of a possible unification of Christianity. The true church, the Jesus Brotherhood, is invisible, spiritual, and is characterized by unity, not necessarily by uniformity. But the Christianity of even the 20th century must not be despised. It is the product of the combined moral genius of the God-knowing men of many races during many ages, and it has been truly one of the greatest powers for good on earth, and therefore no man should lightly regard it, notwithstanding its inherent and acquired defects. Christianity still contrives to move the minds of reflective men with mighty moral emotions. But there is no excuse for the involvement of the church in commerce and politics. Such unholy alliances are a flagrant betrayal of the master, and the genuine lovers of truth will be slow to forget that this powerful institutionalized church has often dared to smother newborn faith and persecute truth bearers who chance to appear in unorthodox raiment. It is all too true that such a church would not have survived unless there had been men in the world who preferred such a style of worship. Many spiritually indolent souls crave an ancient and authoritative religion of ritual and sacred traditions. Human evolution and spiritual progress are hardly sufficient to enable all men to dispense with religious authority, and the invisible brotherhood of the kingdom may well include those family groups of various social and temperamental classes, if they are only willing to become truly spirit-led sons of God. But in this brotherhood of Jesus, there is no place for sectarian rivalry, group bitterness, nor assertions of moral superiority and spiritual infallibility. These various groupings of Christians may serve to accommodate numerous different types of would-be believers among the various peoples of Western civilization, but such a division of Christendom presents a grave weakness when it attempts to carry the gospel of Jesus to Oriental peoples. These races do not yet understand that there is a religion of Jesus, separate and somewhat apart from Christianity, which has more and more become a religion about Jesus. Christianity is an extemporized religion, and therefore must it operate in low gear. High gear spiritual performances must await the new revelation and the more general acceptance of the real religion of Jesus. But Christianity is a mighty religion, seeing that the commonplace disciples of a crucified carpenter set in motion those teachings which conquered the Roman world in 300 years, and then went on to triumph over the barbarians who overthrew Rome. This same Christianity conquered, absorbed, and exalted the whole stream of Hebrew theology and Greek philosophy. And then when this Christian religion became comatose for more than 1,000 years as a result of an overdose of mysteries and paganism, it resurrected itself and virtually reconquered the whole Western world. Christianity contains enough of Jesus' teachings to immortalize it. If Christianity could only grasp more of Jesus' teachings, it could do so much more in helping modern man to solve his new and increasingly complex problems. Christianity suffers under a great handicap because it has become identified in the minds of all the world as a part of the social system, the industrial life, and the moral standards of Western civilization. And thus has Christianity unwittingly seemed to sponsor a society which staggers under the guilt of tolerating science without idealism, politics without principles, wealth without work, pleasure without restraint, knowledge without character, power without conscience, and industry without morality. The hope of modern Christianity is that it should cease to sponsor the social systems and industrial policies of Western civilization, while it humbly bows itself before the cross it so valiantly extols, there to learn anew from Jesus of Nazareth the greatest truths mortal man can ever hear, the living gospel of the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of men. The English is very interesting, isn't it? As the teenagers say today, it swings. Yes.
Going back to the Orient, it fascinates me because I was never acquainted with a Buddhist before, but we had a Buddhist student in our home.
Yes.
Delightful boy.
You'd be very interested.
We had an Arab boy.
Ah, yes.
Those boys are awakening, and we didn't preach to them at all, but we listened and we enjoyed them and loved them. And I guess there are ways, because the Arab boy certainly displayed great resentment and all in pictures that he was an artist and he drew, but the last one that he painted and he left had an entirely different countenance than the first. Mm-hmm. We discussed this before. The Cambodian boy was a Buddhist, and he is, they saw the picture.
Cambodian, he's Hinayana Buddhist. He's fundamentalist Buddhist.
Is that right?
Yes. That's in contrast to Northern Buddhism,
which
is Protestant Buddhism, you might say.
Very interesting comments that they've made here. So I would say the best awakening will come through their exposure to Western Christianity.
Could be. Would you like me to? Yes.
Now, I was just going to say this could be very naive and wrong, but I'll say it.
Don't apologize. Just ask. We're all neophytes of this, you know.
It seems to me, and it's just a very smattering of reading of East and Western religions, that actually, they're all trying to say the same thing.
Sure they are.
In their own terms.
Yes.
And so as such, sometimes the word Christianity, and when you hear it used by, say, a Western leader, I think it's a word that should not be used, because it immediately, publicly, it sounds as if you're being sanctimonious, mm-hmm. and the great, to me, and that can be all wrong, but I wondered about it. Because it's counting.
But is there not a difference of active and passive religion? I mean, the Buddhist is much more in the passive concept of...
That's true of Hinayana Buddhism, but hardly of the Mahayana.
Please?
That's not as true of Northern Buddhism as it would be of original or fundamentalist Buddhism, Hinayana Buddhism, the Buddhism of Burma, Cambodia, Ceylon, in contrast to the Buddhism of Japan, which is a more active Buddhism. There's some contemplation there too. Zen is more contemplative, Shin less so. That's like saying, you know, that the Congregationalists are more liberal, perhaps, than the Episcopalians, High Church. The papers have this to say about different religions. They have, on the preceding page, taken inventory, and they do it chronologically. First Hinduism, the most ancient, then the Hebrew religion, Buddhism, the Confucian teachings, the Taoist beliefs, Zoroastrianism, Shinto, Jainism, Christianity, Islam, and Sikhism, the most recent. They have this to say, the many religions of Urantia are all good to the extent that they bring man to God and bring the realization of the Father to man. It is a fallacy for any group of religionists to conceive of their creed as the truth. Such attitudes bespeak more of theological arrogance than certainty of faith. There is not a Urantia religion that could not profitably study and assimilate the best of the truths contained in every other faith, for all contain truth. Religionists would do better to borrow the best in their neighbor's living spiritual faith rather than to denounce the worst in their lingering superstitions and outworn rituals. You know, I do some talking here and there, and occasionally in churches. And once I was asked to take a little church up in Wisconsin over for a day. And my pal, the Presbyterian minister, told me to do the sermon as well. And so I dug into my library of comparative religion, and I wove a sermon out of direct quotes from so-called pagan texts. I took only one editorial license. Whatever word they had for God, I used a familiar word like God, the Lord, the Almighty, you know. Afterwards, almost everybody came up and shook my hand and wanted to know the source of the sermon. But I just wasn't going to tell them. This would have been too shocking to that congregation. But this was all paganism I was preaching in a Christian altar. And I want to tell you something. It was a beautiful sermon because I didn't write it. I just compiled it. Would you like me to read you something from the life of Jesus? Pick the year you'd like to hear about. You want it when he was a little boy, when he was a teenager, when he was growing up? Let me read you. Can I read you a little story from school days, if I can find it? This is fun.